The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So one of the very gratifying questions that people will come to me with is the question, how do I, now that I've practicing this mindfulness, this meditation seems good, or retreat practice is good, but it has to apply to my life. It has to be relevant for the rest of my life. I want to bring it to my life. How do I do that? And sometimes people will complain. They'll say, well, you know, this meditation is great, but it doesn't really have much to do with everyday life, the real world. And so the real world, everyday life, the rest of our life outside of meditation, you know, it's definitely supposed to be relevant to it all. So we could apply it, to look at it in one particular area of life, a place that's representative of life, or of life in the world, the real world, the area which is, you know, pretty central, one way or the other, central to everyone's life, and that is sex. Buddhism has a history of not addressing the issues of sexuality, of sexual activity, as an area of practice. There's a long history in Asia of teachers there, when they do talk about sex and sexual activity, to look at it almost exclusively through the lens of physical pleasure and the drive for pleasure. And if that's the only understanding of what sex is the idea of pleasure, you get a very narrow kind of view of what it's about and what's possible there. And here in the West, there's, I think, at least in print or in teachings, a much wider understanding of sexuality and being much more complicated than just the pursuit of pleasure. And it might have little bit to do with, they say, the troubadours in France. I don't know how, you know, people say that the idea of romance is kind of a European invention, and that much of the world before the, you know, in the old days, the idea of romantic romance is kind of a relatively new phenomenon. So I don't know if that's true or in what way it's true, but it seems that these 1,000 years ago, the troubadours who sang songs about love and had a big influence on European culture, and from there perhaps out into the world, and now there's lots of things which we think now are normal. We think it's about part of human nature that, you know, maybe came out of culture and developed and so intimately connected to us that we think it's just human nature. So we can look at how practice applies to our sexuality. And almost any Dharma practice, any teachings of Buddhism, any practices of Buddhism, can probably be applied in relationship to our sexual life and apply to it. And it doesn't have to be outside the purview of any of this. And certainly, if we limit the Buddhist teachings around sexuality to the third precept, that one should not be involved in causing sexual harm or sexual misconduct, then again, it's like this emphasis on just has to do with pleasure. It's a kind of very narrow window into what sexuality is. And if you take your range of, you know, all kinds of Buddhist practices or teachings or the famous lists that Buddhism has, and just kind of apply it to our sexual life, it shows there's much more going on. And I think it's a rich exercise to do and very helpful. Sexual expression, sexual life, how we are about our sexual being is a very rich area of our life. It's probably fairly complicated. I think of sexual expression as being one of the most complex forms of communication that there are. And at least I hope it's a communication in a good way. But it involves so many different layers, so many different aspects of our psyche, our history, our culture, our view of self, our understanding of others. And it's quite a complicated kind of thing. So to unpack it, to bring mindfulness into it and start exploring it in different ways, is a lot to learn there. And that's true for people who are not sexually active as well. That sexuality is something that is such deep part of human life that even the choice or the tendency to become asexual or not be in sexual relationships is also a fairly complex thing, or can something we bring mindfulness to, attention to, and understand our relationship to it, our relationship to others through that lens. There's a lot to be discovered in this regard. And when we don't do that, when we don't bring careful attention to our sexuality, then it's very easy for it to be in the unconscious or to operate in unconscious ways, to not really study it and look at it and understand it. And this can be kind of a whole dark area of a person's life. Even people who are quite sexually active sometimes are pretty ignorant about what's really going on under the surface, what drives them, what motivates them, and the emotions, the feeling that's involved. And so to use the tools of Buddhism to look at this area, I think is very helpful. It's rewarding because it maybe brings greater clarity and purity or integrity to this thing, to our sexuality and our choices around sexuality. And also maybe would help us not to act in ways that are harmful to ourselves or to others, or to know how to be involved in the whole sexual kind of world that we live in a way that we have clarity and self-understanding rather than fear or shame or guilt or embarrassment or silence and all kinds of things. So there was a friend of mine who's a Buddhist teacher many years ago was teaching mindfulness. I think it was like MBSR mindfulness, kind of secular mindfulness-based stress reduction, which he was trained in. He got in to teach it in juvenile hall to a bunch of teenage boys who were there in juvenile hall. And so he showed up to teach in this group of boys and it was clear he was going to have a hard time getting their attention. They were not really happy to be there. Maybe they were required to be there. And they were jostling and talking, or I don't know what they were doing, but he said he was going to have a hard time getting their attention, their respect, so they can focus on the class. So he quietly said to them, "Who here wants better sex?" He had their attention. And then he proceeded to teach mindfulness with no reference to sex anymore. So I could just give a regular talk today. Maybe I'll talk the four foundations of mindfulness and just leave it at that. And then we'll all go, it'll all be good. Or we can stay on topic and actually look at this more directly. So I found it very beneficial to take some of these Buddhist teachings and to consider sexuality and sexual action through the lens of it. Then there's been a wonderful feedback loop, or kind of a beneficial loop back, because as that part of my life has gotten more clarity and wiser about it, then it benefits me in my mindfulness and self-understanding in all kinds of other areas of my life as well, including in meditation. I can meditate better because I have a better sense of that part of my world and life. There's not a few people, maybe no one here, but there's not a few people in this world who will sit and meditate and have sexual fantasies. So to understand this part of our life could actually help meditation as well. And so the sexual fantasies don't interfere with this wonderful and deep process of meditation. One of the teachings that I found very useful in considering sexual relationships is the Brahma Viharas, is to reflect on the idea of goodwill, friendliness, kindness, compassion, joy, and sympathetic joy, and equanimity. That somehow, you know, how would I approach this sexual encounter if there was a kind of metta there? Sometimes I've done little workshops on Buddhism and sexuality and have done guided metta meditation practice, a loving kindness practice, and then after doing it for a while and people are still kind of in that meditative mode, we'll ask people now, from this point of view, from this state that you're here, what would it be like for you to approach your lover? How would that be? And how would that be different than maybe how it sometimes is at other times? The other, I think, a really rich area for using Buddhist teachings and practices to look at sexuality, our sexual lives, whether we're actively sexual or not, is the Eightfold Path. And you can go down and learn the teachings and many different perspectives on this Eightfold Path teaching. You can take any of them, any perspective, any teaching. You go to a book and about them and read them and learn them, and then consider, then actively consider, how does this apply? How does each of these Eightfold Steps, how does it apply to my sexual life and my sexual expression, activity? So you take the first one, the eighth, right view. It's the right perspective that the Buddha had emphasized. The idea that the perspective you bring, the orientation, the way in which you look at, what you prioritize in terms of what you look for when you're involved in life is very important. And so if you're just always looking at life through the lens of making more money, you'll see the world in one way. If you look at life only through the lens of where is the pleasure, more pleasure, you see the world in a different way. If you look at it through the lens of fear and where's the danger, you see it in another way. The lens that the Buddha suggested that people have is a lens of the Four Noble Truths. And so the suffering, the arising of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the way to the end of it. And this is the lens of being sensitive to suffering, to stress, to tension that we carry with us. Not so we can have tension or stress or suffering more, but so that we can address it, so that we can kind of be honest about it and work through it. Plenty of people are tolerant of their psychological discomfort, are tolerant of their stress, tolerant of their shame, tolerant of their embarrassment, tolerant of their fear, because they think it's something wrong with them. It's kind of inherently they're bad or they're wrong, and there's nothing's supposed to be different somehow. People put up with it. Buddhism says you don't have to be tolerant of your suffering and psychological distress. You can do something about it. And one of the things you can do that Buddhism says is you can look at what are some of the causes that bring about the suffering, the stress, the tension, the sorrow, the anxiety, the different things that we have that Buddhism calls suffering. And is there something that compulsive thoughts, compulsive fears, compulsive cravings? Are there compulsive identities we have, that we have to be somebody in relationship to other people? We have to prove ourselves in some way. And if we bring compulsive thinking or attachments to our sexuality, it's a pretty good recipe to suffer. And we have to, things have to be a certain way, I have to be a certain way, the experience has to be a certain way, or shouldn't be a certain way, and there's all these things that come into play. So simply to stop, or to, maybe you don't want to stop in the middle of sex, but it wouldn't, sometimes it's not a bad idea to take a look and see, you know, am I really comfortable here? Is there something, some discomfort? Am I somehow feeling tension, stress, Am I feeling oppressed? Am I feeling pressured? You know, what am I feeling here? And what is the cause for that? You could ask for in yourself, maybe something coming from outside. But take a look. And then to begin, the third noble truth is to appreciate that it's possible to live a life that doesn't have this pressure, this stress, this suffering. And that's a powerful teaching. Not so much as a teaching, but as a personal experience to know for oneself that you don't have to. There's no requirement. It's not built into the fabric and nature of the universe that we're supposed to continuously feel distressed, feel depressed, feel contracted, feel depressed. There is an alternative. And the more we practice, the more we have a sense of this alternative. We experience it. We learn to rest in it. And then if we have that experience of absence of freedom, the cessation, the absence of suffering, the cessation of it, that's a powerful reference point to have to, if you really know it for yourself. And then you enter into any activity, including sexual activity. And what do you want to do there? What's important here? Wouldn't it be so much better to engage in this kind of activity without the burden of suffering, of fear, of distress, of demands, of expectations in all kinds of directions? So just to have that simple reflection in what we're doing opens a door for a lot of self-discovery. The second of the Eightfold Path is right intention. The Buddha emphasized as we go about our life, the intention or the attitude which we approach things that makes a big difference. And if what we want is liberation, if we want to be freed of suffering, the approach to do that is dramatically helped by the attitude with which we approach our life, the attitude which we engage. And so he said, you should avoid three things. You should avoid lust. They didn't say to avoid sexual desire, but to avoid lust. And I think that, at least in English language, lust is a very powerful, intense word. And I think in most people's vocabulary, it's maybe not necessarily a good thing to have lust. There can be a different kind of... Sexual desire can take a different form than lust. If lust is a kind of compulsion, if lust is kind of forcefulness and forcing ourselves on someone... So that was one thing the Buddha suggested not having. The other thing he suggested as an attitude to avoid is hostility. The other is cruelty. And unfortunately, there's not just a little hostility and cruelty that can go along with sexual expression. The extreme version of it is sometimes rape, sexual abuse. But even where it's kind of consensual sex sometimes, there's all kinds, as I said, there's so many different forms of communication that go on, so many things being communicated in sexual activity. There can be resentment to the partner that's somehow subtly being expressed or being simmering, even in the middle of sexual activity. And so is there cruelty, is there hostility kind of in the field of what we're doing? So the Buddha suggested we avoid that. Instead, he suggested three helpful attitudes. One attitude is the attitude of simplicity or simplicity around sexual desire. The second is goodwill or kindness. And the third is compassion. So this, you know, relates to this Brahma-vihara as I talked about earlier. Is there compassion? Is there goodwill? Is there kindness in our sexual interests, our sexual activity? And if there isn't, why not? What's going on here? How strong is it, the goodwill? It's not uncommon for some people to lose themselves in a certain way in the sexual activity or the sexual desire is so strong that other forms of relating is not really operating so much. So this, you know, what attitude do we bring to this and what do we want to bring to it? The third of the Eightfold Path is has to do with ethics. It's called the right action. not killing, not taking what is not given, and not being involved in sexual misconduct. So the second one in particular, not taking what is not given, is, there would be no Me Too movement if people were following that precept. Don't take what's not given. Freely given, freely offered. Not a few people have either been the receiver of unwanted sexual advance or been the person doing the unwanted sexual advancement. And there's a lot of suffering that exists in this world because of this. So the simple thing, a commitment not to take what is not given, would go a long way to create a healthier sexuality. And then not causing sexual harm is one of the central precepts of Buddhism. Not involved in sexual misconduct that harms, And that's pretty easy to do. I think that a fair number of people who somehow ended up being teenagers probably were involved in confused sexuality and someone got harmed in the process. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I think that is not so uncommon. The next of the Eightfold Path is right livelihood, and how exactly it applies to sexuality, not always so clear. Maybe all the ways, but certainly there are livelihoods, ways people make their living through sexuality. Some of it, some people who are sex workers, for example. Some of it might be quite ethical, but some of it involves industries of tremendous harm, tremendous suffering. There are dignified sex workers, and then there's prostitutes where it's just an awful scene. People are suffering and getting terrible situation, exploited, and there's a sex trade that exists here in Peninsula. There's all kinds of things that go on that around this people's livelihood and money on sex and all that. Pornography, erotica maybe can be beautiful and inspiring and aesthetic. Pornography can be so demeaning and so create a culture of people who have very confused relationship to sexuality and to sexual partners. So to avoid these things, so that we're not perpetuating livelihoods that cause harm in our society. And then the sixth of the Eightfold Path is right effort. And this is the effort to avoid things which are unskillful, unhealthy, and to cultivate things, states of mind which are healthy. And so to have a sense that there are different states of mind that we can be in, and some are healthy and some are not, and have the ability and the skill to move towards the healthy ones, to move away from discontent, from anxiety, from greed, from lust, from fear, and move towards contentment, towards certain kind of peacefulness, equanimity, to heightened awareness and attention, to being really present in a clear way for the people we're with. There's all kinds of ways in which we can cultivate and develop states of mind that are much more conducive for living a healthy way, and the same thing for our sexual life. There's healthy states of mind with which to engage in sexual activity. And one of the ways to find that is the seventh of the Eightfold Path, which is mindfulness practice. To pay careful attention to what's going on, to really stay in touch with oneself. Don't lose oneself completely. Anytime you get close to sex, some people lose their mind. It's probably good not to lose it so quickly. Kind of stay connected and find out what's going on and notice what's happening. Notice what motivates us, the feelings, the ideas, the tensions that are there. Sometimes sexual activity is done to get away from, it's kind of an escape. Sometimes it's for comfort, sometimes it's for security, sometimes it's for an exchange in order to get something else from the relationship, not just the warm sexual expression, affection. There's all kinds of things that go on. And so if we stop and don't lose our mind, if we stay present, maybe we notice many things that go on. Mindfulness gives us a heightened capacity for being aware of our distress, our tension, the subtle ones. And subtle is not unimportant. And kind of the little bumper sticker for Buddhism, or for, especially for mindfulness, is I stop for suffering. And so, you know, if you want to have good sex, don't suffer. And don't even have a slight suffering. So if you're mindful, you start seeing this and understanding what's going on here and what's happening here for me. And mindfulness also means learning how to have a strong sense of presence, of attention, so that when you're with someone, or I guess there's also sexual expression alone, that you're really there in a stronger, better way. Maybe that's more beneficial for everyone involved. And then there's concentration, and the last of the Eightfold Path. And the Buddha specifically talked about the value of concentration to overcome the attachments to sensual and sexual pleasures. And the way it works is that when a person becomes concentrated, there's a profound sense of well-being. Some of the most profound sense of well-being, of happiness, of joy, of ecstasy that people can experience, can come from a concentrated state. Partly because a concentrated meditation state is a state of unification, it's a state of wholeness, a state where we're not divided up, we're not separated from ourselves, we're not fractured, we're not all the different forces, the energies in our body and our mind have come together in a harmonious way. It's a harmonious state. And it's really remarkable to sit and be present where the whole mind-body feels harmonious, feels content, feels happy, feels maybe more than happy, feels a certain kind of tremendous ecstasy and bliss. And in that state, some people experience a joy, a pleasure that's greater than orgasm. Now that's kind of puts sex in a little different perspective. You know, if orgasm is like the best thing going ever in the world, you know, then let's go for it. More the better. But if you know something that's better and it lasts longer, you know, then, you know, maybe then the focus on sexuality doesn't have to only be the pleasure or the orgasm. There could be maybe, I would suggest, deeper things possible in sexual expression. Sexual expression can be a deep form of communication, of love, of caring, of being connected to someone, of being in touch with someone. There can be a deep communion with someone that might be possible that if we're not distracted by the pleasure of it all. I believe that sexual expression is a powerful and meaningful way to express our love and our affection for people and our connection. But I think many times it's not given that possibility. We're distracted or caught up in other things, and we don't have the ability to settle and make that deep connection. I've known people who are sexually active. A few people I've known have been very sexually active. So, you know, lots of partners. But they've never really been known by someone else in a deep way, and they've never known their partners in a deep way. They were strangers to each other in so many, many ways, because it was all on the surface. It had the purpose of it was maybe to, there was so much insecurity, it was a way of getting some kind of temporary security, or a way of feeling like you're important, or you feel distracted from your other suffering. All kinds of things, reasons why people will engage in sexual activity that have nothing to do with the profound, deep connection to the partner. And so to go through this Eightfold Path and kind of review one's sexual life, one's relationship to sexuality, how we are, then is a way of clarifying in such a way that it allows our sexuality to have a greater value, become more meaningful. It can allow us to make a stronger, deeper connection to others and to ourselves. And perhaps in that process, it supports us in a path towards liberation. The greater self-understanding we have, the greater we understand where the clinging is and the attachments are. And if we can learn to let go of those attachments and clinging, we're on the path to liberation and freedom. And then the great experiment, the great research project, is to discover what's it like to be involved in your sexuality, whether you're asexual or non-sexual or autosexual or partnered sexual or polysexual, or be involved in sexuality in such a way that there's no greed, no hate, no fear present whatsoever. What's that like? That would be a good thing to discover. Liberated sexuality. So that was an example of the application of Buddhist teachings to our sexual lives. There could be other. Pick any teachings that are offered, and you can run the exercise for yourself, or not, as you wish. But if you don't bring your practice to your sexuality, then you should be a little bit slow to come to a Buddhist teacher and say, you know, this meditation, it's okay, you know, but it really has to apply to my ordinary life, daily life, you know, the real world, but not sexuality. Because nothing gets, if anything is real in the real world, I mean, it got to be sexuality. I mean, that's why you're here. All of you, right? I mean, someone, once upon a time, did a sexual act that means that you're here. So that was a pretty real thing. So the real world. So Buddhism in the real world. Good luck. So we have about 10 minutes for questions, testimonials. Or did I speak to the wrong audience? It turns out it was an irrelevant topic.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak to define or find differences between lust, passion, and desire.
Nice. Well, just the fact that you would think that there's a distinction between those three, I think is pretty interesting. And is it fair enough for me to ask you how you use the word differently?
I'm going to blush. Well, lust feels like more out of control, out of control. Mm-hmm. Passion feels like there's a cause that's pushing. And desire, I guess, wanting.
Good. Yeah, I think that for me, I think of lust as being out of control, it's very strong compulsion. And you know, sometimes we're not really in charge of ourselves. And I mean, when I was younger, there were times where I was sexually interested, and I kind of was out of control a little bit, you know. And then passion, I think of as a just. I kind of have a nice feeling for the word passion. I don't know if other people have the same association, but it just seems like a great enthusiasm. And desire is just a neutral word. Just it covers all that is this, craving and aspiration. Lust is a form of desire. Desire is just like the generic word for this whole wide range of ways we desire. But if there can be simple desire. I have a lot of desires of all kinds, and I sometimes say that desires are like a dime a dozen for me. They just come and go, and I just let them come and go. And not so many of them have to do with sex anymore, but certainly I have a lot of desires, I probably should admit what some of them are. Because you'll doubt my sanity, but a lot of them have to do with getting more time to look in Pali English dictionaries. So is that good enough? Can you take it right back behind you?
Thank you so much for the talk, Gil. It's something that I have never heard anybody talk about in a Buddhist context before. So I really thank you for that. I don't know if I exactly have a question. I guess I'm just your talk reminds me of how in our society it seems sometimes that having good sex with someone that you're attracted to and that's attracted to you is like the highest good. And the absolute best thing that you can achieve in life, and so there's a lot riding on it in that sense. And I sometimes also feel as a straight man that it's very unlikely for me to get love and affection and kindness and caring except in the context of a sexual relationship with a woman. So there's a lot riding on it in that sense as well.
Mm.
It's so it becomes almost not to do with lust or something that you're satisfying or greed or something like that, but about your basic human needs.
So it's not even about sex, but sex is the vehicle for some deeper need.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know what you would say to that, or if it even is related to the topic that you were talking about.
No, I think it's right to the point of this subject. So I heard you say two things. One I heard is that, it wasn't your words, but sometimes sex is overrated. Way overrated. It's like so I think we have to be aware that we have a highly sexualized culture, where the value or the importance of sex is built up hyped up quite a bit, and so it's overvalued and overrated. And there are better things than sex, absolutely. But sex is good. I mean, it's a nice thing as well. And the other is this very important point that sometimes it's not the sex that's important for people and what drives it, but there's this deeper human needs. And I think it's really helpful to have those needs met in other ways. If the only outlet, the only vehicle is through sex, I think it skews the sex. It doesn't, and the full potential, the beneficial potential of sex doesn't really come alive. I think it's to look for other places to have rich human relationships. There are ways of doing that. And if you can't, there are places to go. And like you talked about being a man, so there are men's groups you can join. And some men's group meets for decades, and they have developed slowly over time. They develop very deep human relationships with other men. There are a Buddhist meditation retreat. It's remarkable. 7 days in silence with a group of people. You think that they're just it's kind of impersonal, but the depth of feeling and connection that can happen is quite strong. I came back from one yesterday. And at the end of the 7 days, some people were in awe of the feeling of community and connection that happened of being in retreat together. There's probably more effective, efficient ways than being in silence for 7 days. But there's things you can do, and if you don't have, don't know of something you can do to create richer human relationships, then I think it can be helpful to go get the support of either a counselor or a coach who can really explore this territory and find different avenues for that. But it's not rocket science to figure out how to make this happen.
Thank you.
So last one up here, if you can have the mic up in the front. And then and I'll try to answer the question quickly.
So a lot of topics in Buddhism, it evolved in the West. You had once mentioned that mindfulness of the feeling tone, that is not practiced so much in Southeast Asia and other places, but it's a very Western concept. Mindfulness of the body tone, it is, you had mentioned it in one of your talks. I'll dig out the
okay.
talk for you.
Oh yeah. Okay.
But is mindfulness of sexuality, is it something, is it a Western thing, or does the Buddha talk about it? The reason is, this is generally a topic which is considered a not so useful topic in the East. You had mentioned this in many of your talks too, that in the East, when people become less sexually active in their 40s, it's considered a relief, whereas in the West, they go for Viagra and things like this. And evolutionally, if you see the body, the organism, we were perfected for two things, reproduction and staying out of danger, which means a lot of fear and unnecessary emotions. So both these are not conducive for awakening. So that was very well realized by the Buddha and others. So that being said, there's a lot of these books about mindfulness of sexuality and all this. Is this a Western concoction, or did the Buddha really talk about this?
No. The Buddha said really nothing about mindfulness of sexuality. Mostly he said monastics should not be involved in sex whatsoever. And if a lay person... has to do it, then it should be, with a spouse or somebody who is, fits the categories of appropriate partner. So it was more like, if you have to do it, then at least do it ethically. That's about the extent of it. As I said earlier, that we have here in the modern West, we have a whole legacy of a different understanding of human nature. There's romance, connection between people. We have a much richer psychological understanding in some ways than we had in ancient India. So I think, and for lay people who are not going to become monastics, but who are serious about doing Buddhist practice, it makes sense to bring your practice into your sexuality, not to leave it off the table and just let it kind of be neurotic. You want all your life to be part of practice, and maybe I think of it as an experiment to see how far we can go. It's possible that some sexual activity would, as people mature in practice, would fall away. Some of it might fall away, but some of it might remain and becomes maybe more refined or more detailed, or not the carrier of all our neurotic needs that it might be. So it's an experiment. So, but in ancient Buddhism, you find very, very little about this. In most of Buddhism, and I mean even the modern West, you don't find that much about it, this topic. I think some people, some teachers, some classic teachers might feel that. To give this kind of talk, with the kind of talks about the, how to practice with sexuality, is just kind of pointing people in the wrong direction. People can get more attached now and more caught up in the world, but that's not the intention. The intention is to help us become freer, and if the practice is relevant for all our lives, it should be relevant there as well. And what happens as a result of that will vary from person to person. And I've known some people for whom the practice of Buddhism, not just focusing on sexuality, but the practice of it, freed up their inhibitions, freed up their fears and things in such a way that their life became, their sexual life became much freer and richer in a good way. And I've known other people who've had a fine sexual life, and as they practiced, they found that they became less and less interested, and they didn't feel bad about it or felt like they had to let go of it, but it didn't have the same importance it had before. And there were other ways of being that seemed to have more importance, and they felt completely fulfilled and happy, and it wasn't such a big need. So, I think it'd be good for our society for more of us to bring a greater attention to this part of our life. I think just this tremendous wave of the Me Too movement that's come across this globe is an indication of how much suffering, tremendous amount of oppression and suffering that exists around sexuality. There's so much pain that gets formed, so much abuse, so much cruelty. And I mean, it's just astounding, you know, what goes on in the wider world. And I think that some of it comes from the fact that it's an ignored part of our life. And if we stop ignoring it and become wise about it and understand it better, I think that we'll start seeing that it's not going to stay in the dark anymore, and it'll hopefully make a cultural difference. So some people need to look at this. Some people need to wake up and be attentive and to become wise by this whole area. And I think one of the ways to become wiser is to take your Buddhist practice and apply it to this area. And you have this wonderful Eightfold Path. It's like a little, you know, sex by numbers. Get to eight and start over again in one. So enjoy. Thank you.